if I wasn't going to be an auto worker or a steel worker or a nurse, then I didn't need a union, right? That's completely false. I quickly learned that when I got here. And so part of being involved in what the work that we're doing is to engage you all on what we're doing, but also for us to stand up and fight for the issues that are important for you. I just left a meeting at Center for American Progress, which is hosted by Campus Progress. Are you guys familiar with Campus Progress? It's another good organization you guys should check out. Campus Progress is the youth arm for Center for American Progress, a progressive thinking think tank. Campus Progress involves a lot of students across the country, a blog out there, the book about, and things like that. And we're tackling the issue of student debt, right? The cost of going to college. And as you know, that the student debt crisis has reached $1 trillion. What is the barriers for you all from acquiring a college degree, paying back those student loans if you have to take them out, and getting a good job once you're done to get a return on the investment that you made in your own education? And so for the first time, I think in a very long time, the AFL-CIO said student debt is going to affect a large number of American workers moving forward. We need to be ahead of the game and be involved. That's one element of how we're involved in college. Also, the student debt issue, I'm pretty sure you guys are aware of the student federal loan interest rate doubling. Have you guys heard about that? It is. We brought in some of the leading youth works around the country to talk to us on how best to get involved in that fight. And so our lobbyists here in the building, who fight on any number of issues, work with us and these youth groups and how we can utilize our influence as an institution of labor to speak for young people, many of whom are not card-carrying anymore. Because, as Amanda said, everything that you see in this building is paid for by union workers and their dues. But it's not just our job to fight only for union workers, it's a fight for all workers. And that means it's not only our job for me to look out for young union members within the Federation, but to fight for all of you. Because, ideally, I'd love for you all to join a union or create a union where workplaces you're in. But, you know, we need to make sure that the labor movement is one that lifts all votes. And so we want to make sure that we're fighting for you guys on a daily basis. In addition to what we're doing on the issue of student loans, we're also very much involved in the electoral campaign. Young people, and I kid you not, are going to be a huge factor in this election. And I think a lot of people try to downplay your involvement in the electoral process because they say that young people don't turn out. Right? Have you guys heard that before? If young people don't turn out, they're flaky voters, they're not involved, they're too busy on Facebook and Twitter, and they're not doing anything. And that is completely false. The wave of young people that came out in 2008 was a significant contributor to the president's ability to win the White House. And the lack of young people that turned out in 2010 was a significant contributor into the GOP winning back the House and a lot of the state legislatures in the Senate. Politics and elections matter, and you guys are going to represent one third of the electorate by 2016. So the bargaining and electoral power that our generation has, and I put us in this, you know, the same boat because we're all millennials, is very, very influential because we're going to be the largest generation in American history. We're going to be the most educated in American history, and we're going to face some of the largest challenges in American history. The jobs crisis, student debt, we're going to be the most indebted generation in American history. We're going to be the most diverse, but we're seeing inequities in income, wealth, all across the board. There are major challenges that we need to come together and address as a generation, and our values are significantly different than what. So you look at CPAC, which is a conservative conference that they have. 20 years ago, marriage equity was a major divisive issue. Now, if you talk to young CPAC members who are there, they're saying marriage equity is not a thing for us anymore. We believe in this. The trends, the values that we have as a generation are going to shape what the country looks like. What do we value? What do we spend money on? What do we support? And that's about our ability to participate. And our goal, part of the political program, is not to just engage the millions of union members around the country, but to engage the 80 million members of our generation to participate in this election, and to get your friends to participate. and the effectiveness that you all will have in getting your dorm mates to come out and vote is infinitely more important than anything that I, President Crumfeld, or anyone else can send out, because peers listen to peers. And if you're out there not in your dorm or in, on Erie Lansing or going around the communities and saying, you need to turn out, you need to vote, are you registered? Does your campus have polling sites that you guys can access? Do you guys, are you in a state legislative system where your student IDs work as voting IDs? Your student in the state of Pennsylvania, that's not the case. And so not only are we fighting for students, our young people at a federal level, we also need to do that on the local level. So we have a program called My Vote, My Right, which is specifically engaged to protect voters both when they go and cast a ballot, but also to register new voters. I don't care who you vote for. I care that you vote. I absolutely despise the process that's going on across the country with voting ID laws, because a great deal of it is targeting young people and punishing them for coming out and voting. Because they know that you have the ability to sway the election. So every state, the 31 states that have voter ID laws that specifically say student IDs do not count, is an attack on your ability to participate in your democracy. And think about it. There is a conscious effort to lead you out of the process, to take your voice out of the democratic process. And so when we, the political department, talk about registering voters, protecting voters, doing away with ID laws, that's protecting not only older citizens, citizens of color, and people that disadvantaged communities, but young people. Because you guys are making the decisions. If you don't start participating, that's not going to happen. And so what we do, part of my job is to make sure the issues that affect young people, labor and non-labor alike, are being addressed through the entire lens that is labor. So public policy and again, the rural citizens will protect and social science, to making sure that when we do polls and mailings and we target young people, to hire young people as organizers, to talk on campuses and communities, and to engage you to be active participants, one within the democratic process in this campaign, but also to make sure fight for the issues in effect. And the labor movement is interested in being participating in politics, and Elizabeth will get into this more, she has much more experience than I do. It's part because there's so many things that affect us in the world of work that is being protected or negated by public policy and elections. See, who has had summer jobs before at like a fast food restaurant? Or maybe civil construction, right, houses or things like that. Should work at a retail store or something like that, summer jobs. Like, a lot of young people get hurt at a greater rate than older workers in these entry-level jobs. There's not enough protections for people who are looking for a first time to go to work at Burger King and are applying for a job this summer, and they get burned, there's no protections for them. So we need to make sure that laws that affect worker safety are being enforced and implemented mostly. So there's a wide breadth of reasons for us to get involved in the political process. That's from public policy at the federal and state level, that's from lobbying at the federal and state level, that's from doing issue area campaigns, as well as electoral and GOT. I don't want to take up too much time, Elizabeth is far more experienced and much more in-depth understanding of this. It's 10 times the training than this time, and I hope to be. So,
you understand a lot of
Yeah, I'll take a couple of questions and I'll give it over.
Yeah, I'm sorry, one question. Earlier you mentioned the issue with the IDs.
Yeah.
And you're saying that this is an attack being hit around young people. Who exactly is behind this?
Well, most of the ID laws that you see are being perpetuated or pushed by ALEC. You guys know who ALEC is? ALEC, I don't know the acronym, the
American Legislative Exchange Council.
American Legislative Exchange Council is an organization that was created by several large business executives that wanted to push state legislation that was beneficial in supporting their bottom line. Part of that is realizing that when you expand the electorate to include more people, generally those people vote Democratic. new voters, older voters, young voters, communities of color, generally vote more Democrat. So what you're seeing is a population that's becoming more diverse, is younger, and a lot of people that turned out in the last election helped the Democratic Party. If you could shrink the electorate, if you can shrink the pool, those who are likely to come out are those who are generally likely to support conservative or GOP candidates, right? And so you can't win on the ideas, then you change the game, right? You move the goalposts, you shrink the playing field, the whole nine yards. So voter ID, like the idea of voter fraud affecting elections is a myth, like mermaids are a myth. It's not going to happen, right? Does it happen? Yes, but it's at such a small scale, it doesn't even affect the margin of error that you get from a voting machine that just generally makes a mistake. So, I think the Brennan Center at NYU actually calculated you have a greater likelihood to be struck by lightning twice to find massive voting biases. And so, that ally realized that they could win more seats by shrinking the electorate, creating more barriers for entry in terms of how you vote. And the best way to do that is to make the process more difficult. And one way to do that is to force people to get government-issued IDs, to make them more specific, and to make the process of getting those IDs harder. So if you're in your late teens, if you're born in a rural area of the UP, right, if you're born in your home or on a farm, you don't have a birth certificate, right? That's something you might need to get an ID sometimes. And so there's a lot of people who are not part of that system. So shrinking the electorate allows GOP and conservative interest groups and corporate allies to kind of push the urgent. Anything else? Okay, so thank you.
Kristen? One of the things we do here in the FSCI building is juggle numerous meetings and activities. And I'm about to head out to a quick meeting upstairs. And actually, it's on what we call the Workers' Voice Conference. So conservatives have this organization, ALEC. Every year, the FSCI sponsors a conference called Workers' Voice, where we bring together 250 local labor officials who work directly with their state legislators and basically formulate alternative legislation, work around a whole range of issues having to do with workers' rights and democracy. We're in the middle of planning that right now. But our next speaker is Elizabeth Bowen. Elizabeth is the director of the AFL-CIO Organizing Department, and she's also the former Secretary-Treasurer of the United Auto Workers, and she's been involved in many, many union organizing campaigns, collective bargaining, negotiations, and a tremendous amount of innovative activities over the years.
And welcome to the House of Labor. It's good to be with you. I'm sure Kristen already did the obligatory Go Blue, which my
just trying to make friends.
So I'm not sure exactly how much of an overview, you know, if the topic is why are humans involved in politics, I think you have to step a little bit back and you can see a bigger picture there. And that is the relationship of the level of unionization with the level of inequality. And the role that the labor movement plays, not only in this country, but around the world, on social issues, and the relationship of global unionization and political democracy. So in that order, there are many studies that link the level of unionization, and I should have brought actually coming down in this before the end of that, coming down, the level of unionization with income inequality in this country. And as literally, the graph is like this, by the authors of the Center for American Progress. So as the level of unionization goes down in the country, the level of inequality has gone up. And as I'm sure all of you know right now, the level of inequality in this country is greater than in 100 years, maybe even the greatest of all times. And to say that the only reason was the decline in unionization would be untrue, that there was a direct correlation. Unionization of political democracy, you're all too young to remember the Iron Curtain and the Cold War, and but, you know, back in the day, our government actually supported trade union movement in the Eastern Bloc countries to literally overthrow their governments. And those movements, by and large, came out of the independent trade union movement. And there is, again, many, many studies demonstrating that without a vibrant, free, democratic trade union movement, it is maybe not impossible, but it certainly has never happened in history where you could have that kind of political democracy that we're accustomed to in the industrial age without a vibrant labor movement. And then finally, the role of the labor movement on social issues. And if you care about social issues, you have to care about having a thriving labor movement in this country, because the labor movement has been part and parcel of every movement for social progress and social change, again, since the beginning of the 20th century, at least. So minimum wage, child labor, Civil Rights Act of 1964, discrimination against women, both on the job and off. The court cases, that every single court case that you think of is as being landmark, that the Whitman has participated in, including the University of Michigan case, that I'm of course pointing on the name of, but that established that universities could take into account diversity and admissions policy. The labor movement supported that by filing an amicus brief in that case. Actually, even more than that, the UAW participated in encouraging the auto workers to also file a complete brief in that case. So, right now, the level of unionization is the lowest it's been again since the early part of the 20th century. And that decline has been slow and steady. There have been blips along the historic chart. The blips have corresponded, you know, hard to always imagine what causes blips. That's something we spend a lot of time talking about here. If you'd like another blip in that one direction. But certainly among those are a robust economy, often coming out of the doldrums economy, and part of it is also political. So you see the passage of the National Labor Relations Act and huge amounts of labor union activity. The passage of laws among the states to allow public sector collective bargaining, which didn't happen until the 1960s, and again, a huge increase in the rate of unionization. Again, there's a cause and effect there, because what you say in organizing departments is the law power of organizing. It's not true of organizing power of the law. And again, I think the examples that I just gave, the National Labor Relations Act and the passage of the total sector collective bargaining laws in the 60s are good examples of that. Lots of organizing was known, was happening on the ground, and as a result, the laws changed from that grassroots activity. So, over the last few years, probably the span of your lives, we've seen an indescribably intense anti-union conduct that we see both on the economic side of the picture and on the political side of the picture. On the economic side, in the private sector, a labor campaign, a union campaign in the work site is met universally by brutal, vicious, unrelenting employer opposition. I believe that if the American people understood what workers had to undergo, and what is a union after all? Union is just having some, the workers having a voice in the shaping of their wages, hours, and working conditions. A union in a workplace is comparable to a student council in the student government in high school or college. It's worker democracy. It was described that even back, again, back in the day in the 30s and 40s, huge organizations going out in the private sector, it was described as industrial democracy. And that's, you know, for all of the name calling and the, you know, the craziness and the rhetoric, that's really all over the news. Majority of workers in the workplace deciding for themselves to act collectively with their employer, sit down collectively with their employer, with representatives that they elect. Not with representatives decided by the employer, but representatives that they elect. And the idea that that simple concept could be met with the intimidation, retaliation, harassment, discharge, threatened to close, reprisals for this kind of workplace activities. But again, there's lots and lots of empirical data about what happens in virtually every single organizing campaign just to prevent members from being able to sit down with their employer and say in their working conditions. So the economic side of that coin is, you know, it's frankly or high for the 1%, if you will, because again, of this incredible correlation between level of union density and inequality. And, you know, you're all, how many people are here from Michigan? So, you know, in the auto industry, there's been a lot of criticism of the wages and benefits of auto workers. But the truth is that the wages and benefits of auto workers help to create a thriving middle class in Michigan. And I don't know if any of you work on some of them, but for me, I just could not understand the level of hatred for the idea that someone who's worked on an assembly line, back breaking, mind-numbing work for 30 years would be able to have kind of retirement, decent pension, and health care. And to me, that those are things that everyone should have. And so that their antagonism towards all of the workers for having that was just really mysterious to me. And just as an aside, when the auto bridge loans, we worked really in need as a big follow-up at the time, we're really close to the United Way, both in Michigan and around the country, because United Way, you know, if you got rid of auto workers, like they destroyed the union, they themselves would be, and certainly in Michigan, I mean, both would exist, but they get so many contributions from individual auto workers. But because of the relationship between inequality and work, well, and, you know, in industrial democracy, if you look at the, again, the 30s and 40s, when the auto workers and the steel workers and the mine workers began to organize industrially before it just went by craft, what happened? Retail clerks started organizing, hotel and restaurant workers started organizing. You can see, if any of you have done any labor industry tours in Detroit, how those early sit-down strikes were followed by a series of other actions in industries. So there's huge 4-1%, if you will, and I know that's turned a little bit dated now, but you understand what I mean when I talk about that. There's huge stakes and huge implications. There's also political implications, because as Kirsten was describing, the vote of young people, that's also true for union voters. Members of union across any demographic tend to vote more Democratic than a comparable non-union Democratic, non-union demographic. So if you're gonna compare, you know, 50-year-old white men who are in unions to 50-year-old white men who are not in unions, the number of vote, the percentage of vote Democratic is significantly and universally higher. That's true, again, down to gun owner, but to gun owner you know, fundamentalist churchgoer to fundamentalist churchgoer. And there's a lot of reasons for that. And one of the reasons is that unions not only do have the economic best interests of their membership, but the membership understands that their union has their economic best interests at heart and need endorsement. Now, they're not going to listen to their union if their union told them to be a Catholic versus be a Hindu, because that's none of the union's business. But when it comes to bread and butter issues, union members trust and understand, again, the union has their best interests at heart and trust the endorsement process very democratic as well. But as a consequence of that, for the same reason that voter ID laws are aimed at disenfranchising certain groups of workers, by the same token, decreasing unionization also has a political component. And that, you know, it's no coincidence that you see in industrial heartland the particular attacks over the last few years, Scott Walker in Wisconsin, lovely versus Snyder in Michigan, what's his name in Ohio, case of thank you in Ohio, Indiana's always a threat in the West states, they've been pretty conservative all along, they have high unit intensity. So from the labor movement's perspective, just as there's attacks on us about sort of at the work site and not for economic reasons and for political reasons, our fight back has both economic components and political components. Way back years ago, Walter Luther said the bread box is as important as the ballot box. Or excuse me, the ballot box is as important as the bread box because the ballot box can take away what you want in your collective bargaining. And that statement is as true today as it was when we started probably in the 50s, maybe the early 60s. But there's so much, you know, health and safety, so many social protection laws affect, again, the bread and butter lives of union members that we have to be involved with. Safety and health standards, anti-discrimination provisions, pension protection laws, social security, minimum wage, and so on, all are important protections for American workers, not just union workers. But there's an additional reason that again has come up more recent years with the Scott Walkers and the Rick Snyders, and that is that these governors on the state level and their counterparts on the federal level really want to take away the rights of collective bargaining. That is anathema, again, for political reasons and economic reasons. And we have to be involved politically, like we were in Ohio, for example. Like, I'm sure if you have not already heard, you will be coming up the collective bargaining amendment that will be on the ballot in the state of Michigan. Protect our jobs, I think, save our jobs, it can probably make it better jobs. Designed, again, these are political, the activities of a political variety that help the concept, help us foster and nurture collective bargaining. One of the key goals of our political campaigns is to make it easier, or at least less difficult, for workers to be able to organize, whether in the private sector or the public sector. So in many states, the public sector can workers form unions through signing authorization cards and not have to go through complicated, more often contentious election campaign. And it's called card check. But really all it is just let you decide if you had a class action against Michigan State for some reason, you could all authorize a lawyer to represent you. You wouldn't have a superpower of election to do that. And that's what designating a union is really, it's just authorizing someone to act on your behalf collectively. So, you know, many states, California, Massachusetts, Oregon, Washington, is it Washington? I forget, so, New Hampshire, have, again, by law, public sector employees can, form their own unions at their own workplaces through authorization process, the partnership process. You know, the labor movement for several years was unified in trying to enact the Employee Choice Act, which again took away some of the barriers that private sector employees face in Oregon, and but for the untimely death of Senator Kennedy and the untimely seating of, Minnesota at Franken, so that law wouldn't have passed. So for all these reasons, unions are very involved politically. It's part of the core work that we do, and again, helping this country and around the world.
We probably should do some questions, and then we'll bring up our other guests, and we can talk about every other business organization. Any questions that you guys have, if you have any, we're just talking about?
Democracy, I guess, it's all about what we think that, you're so many members, you have, pretty big impact, as, you know, compared to the L, group. So I'm wondering, with your proximity to, the White House, how much corporate influence is there, on the political leaders?
Well, incalculable amounts of corporate influence. If you look at union contributions to even the Democratic Party, corporate contributions of the Democratic Party, forget the Republican Party, are so far greater than union and union membership contributions that it's stunning, really. And so I wish I had the numbers to be able to find for the but by and large, the biggest contributions to the Democratic Party and the Republican Party come from the corporate elite. Not necessarily through corporations, but through the, it's some corporate money and some, obviously, very, very wealthy donors. With Citizens United, you're going to see that more and more. Political democracy, I mean, we used to say we had political democracy in this country, but we're moving away from democracy. We have certain economic tyranny that can see from the control of the economy, actually at 0.1%. But you know, political democracy is being stripped away, and it's pretty alarming and ready.
Thanks so much.
Anyone else?
Yeah. So what is specifically the first step that needs to happen in order to reverse this trend or decline in activity and membership? Is it start at the grassroots level, or you're just focused more on policy reversing the trend?
Yeah, I think those are great questions, and actually form a perfect segue. So let me start off by introducing Jennifer Hillary-Trout, who is in charge of a lot of innovative organizing that's going on, especially in the Denver Community and Corporate Center. And Christian Sweeney is deputy director of the organizing department. Also hails from the, from Michigan. And since it's over 200 years, and actually, yeah, his union started in the University of California, organizing the teaching. The answer is, I think they both, you know, we believe really firmly that the law follows where it has. So you have to have grassroots activity. But that said, the laws in this country really are horrible for workers in lots of ways. And so we're sort of on parallel tracks. Because it's going to be really hard to regain strength when it's so difficult for workers to confront the boss. Now, that's not to say it's impossible, because it's not. You see every day every day inspirational stories of workers who take on the boss. So I we are not no Sequoia people here, but you know, to have a strategy, you have to acknowledge that if there is significant, I just significant roadblocks in the way through the threat and loss that we have. So one of the strategies that we have is working more closely with low-wage and vulnerable persons, their representatives that they've democratically formed on their own to worker centers. And we're pushing to talk more about other organizing that were part of our program.
Sure, so okay, I can do that. So my name is Jennifer Gates. I welcome everyone. How is everyone doing today? After lunch, people are probably doing that. So just to give you a little background on myself, I was born in Colombia. I was raised in Texas. I've been at AFL now for a little over 2 years and work primarily on immigrant worker issues here, which are both passion personally of mine, also professionally. Part of the reason I do this work is because it's really not only important to me, but it's very personally mine as well. So my dad was a maintenance worker growing up, and my mom was a nanny, and she cleaned houses. And during the summer, I would go and spend my time with them at work, and I saw some of the big issues that they faced at their job and how it affected not only their workplace, but really extended on to family issues as well. So my mom, for instance, took care of 3 kids, and the employer would just drop off the kids on the weekends and not pay them for those hours. And it casually required her to work, overnight without, little to no payment for that. And these are some issues you see across the board nationally in employment relationships, oftentimes where there is no collective bargaining. They don't have labor protection from the National Labor Relations Act. And these are folks often who benefit the most from union membership because oftentimes don't have access to that. So for me, it was very personal growing up because of the experiences that I lived with. And before I came to the AFL-CIO, I worked at a worker center in Connecticut where we saw on a daily basis people would come into our office and say, I haven't been paid for food, so do I need that? My employer is harassing me on the job sexually. What can I do about this? Or I just cut off my finger at work and they're telling me I have to see a company doctor and they won't pay for the compensation for this. And so at that, at the worker center where I was, a lot of times the difficulty was getting people to shift from seeing these problems as individual problems to the solution being collectively organizing together. And that was a real, important shift for folks to make, but it was difficult at times as well. So my capacity here at AFL, I work to build relationships and partnerships between worker centers and unions. So just by show of hands, how many people here are familiar with the term worker center? So let me back up a little bit then. So worker centers is basically a community-based organization that serves to improve the lives of low-wage workers, oftentimes immigrant workers. And they're deeply rooted in the communities where they come out. And they come out of very basic needs, right? People need pay their bills, feed their children, bring food on the table. And about a dozen years ago, there were maybe five or six worker centers in the United States. Today, there's over 100, which shows just the dramatic increase in the need for them. And a lot of times, they have emerged in industries that aren't necessarily represented by unions. So a lot of these worker centers work with domestic workers, nannies, housekeepers, cleaners, taxi workers, who are often classified as independent contractors, or also restaurant workers. There's also day laborers who work on the corners of the streets and are the most vulnerable, oftentimes, to violations of labor rights. And as a result, you've seen over the past 10 years, there's been a real institutional rising of these collaborations between workers on the ground and also on the national level. And so now, today, there's actually 5 national networks that serve to represent worker centers on the ground. And so there's the Domestic Workers United. Ivan Koo, who's the head of that, was just nominated to be one of the 100 most influential people in the world. There's also the Endelon Center, which is the National Day Labor Organizing Network, Interfaith Work Justice, and LACID, and Restaurant Opportunity Center, SIPS. organizing for restaurant workers. So over the past several years, the AFL-CIO has made a strategic decision to partner more collaboratively and build deeper relationships with these workers. And it's a result of growing awareness of the need to really provide support and strategic campaigning and build relationships with workers that oftentimes face some of the most severe violations of their human and immigrant and workers' rights on the jobs every single day. So just to give a quick anecdote, I spent several weeks over the past month in Wisconsin working with the workers that are there who have been organizing a campaign of pizza workers who are currently on strike. And it's a pizza factory plant that manufactures frozen pizza, it's a growing, booming economy for them. Christian was there with me as well. And just talking to the workers on the picket line today, and a lot of these families have those workers out of a job, down strike, and have been in that way condition for 6 weeks. And you can just picture how do you really survive in those conditions. And talking to the picket line, made friends with one of the guys, Manuel, who was telling me how he was, working on one of the machines. Every day, we do this all the time. We order a thing, and somebody got stuck in the machine, just take your hand really quickly and dig it out. And one day, he did that, and it chopped off part of his finger. And that finger was never found again. And so that's sort of the daily conditions that people have to deal with. When you think about, you go to work, do you expect to come home with all five fingers, like any chance? So right now, they're organizing right now for health and safety reasons, for discrimination that they're facing on the job, for wage and hour issues. And these are very real, important, critical issues to deal with and to address that impact their lives in deep and meaningful ways. So Christian, I think, can talk about a little more about the strategy behind those and for other organizing campaigns and provide some more insight into that. But I'm happy to also answer any other questions regarding worker centers, immigration issues, and workers in general.
So I'll just speak for just a few minutes about sort of what role we play here in Federation in terms of our ability to organize campaigns, and then we'll open up to a lot of questions. It's not something you could was a question to take off to go to that meeting, but I'll just say a little bit about what else we do. So how many people here, I guess, have a sense of how workers organize the union, what steps they go through? So maybe a little bit, I've got just a quick little handout here that maybe helpful. It was kind of the first question I had when I got involved in organizing my workplace. I thought I didn't know how big the group today was going to be, so maybe I think we need to buddy up.
We can make more later.
Okay, super. Yeah, I'm happy to run out more or email. But I just wanted to say a little bit about sort of typically how these things work. What happens when workers want to form a union? And then take a step back and then we'll talk a little bit about what impact that has. And then also, in addition to the work center work, what are the strategic initiatives we have going on to try and answer the next question of policy work and develop around how do we do that? So this is just a quick little diagram of typically how the workers organize in a workplace. And so the reason for putting this in this timeline, the reason for putting this timeline is to sort of show that this is a process that goes, from as it starts and ends, hopefully, that along the way, there are key decisions that workers and unions have made, and that it's also a democratic process. So, typically, when workers decide to organize, they form an organizing committee. The union that they partner with does research and helps train the workers to have what union, what conversations they need to have with their coworkers, how that should work. And then you sign up a majority, right? You try and get majority support for the union. At that point, Elizabeth was talking about the Employee Choice Act. You sort of have a choice in which direction to go. You can, even without the Employee Choice Act, employers can choose to recognize a union on the basis of how many people sign union authorization forms. That's what this completely is, it says, you know, request margin. The way that process works is if the majority of people sign cards, you get a neutral in to a neutral party to come up with the cards. If the tech can be able to from an arbitrator to a clergy person, if somebody doesn't have a stake and give that one trust and doesn't have a stake in the outcome, and then they look to see if the majority of workers, you know, back in list, see if the majority supports, boom, you move on. But employers aren't obligated to do that in the United States. In most of the rest of the world, in most of the rest of the industrialized world, we have labor law systems that actually allow people to join unions that much. That's one of the things that makes for the difference between, let's say, the United States and Canada, or, you know, the United States and most of Western Europe, in terms of how many workers are in our unions. In the alternative, you can file a petition with the National Labor Relations Board. The board will schedule an election, and then you've got to run a campaign to win that vote. And then afterwards, you know, regardless of the outcome, this is appeals. Part of the problem with the NLRB route or equivalent public sector laws is there's tons and tons of opportunities for employers to appeal different decisions that have been made along the way by the National Labor Relations Board, which can delay the process and really keep the agenda for years. It's a very hard to do that. But in the end, you know, unions get certified, and unions are legally obligated to bargain and represent their workers. And then this is where the sort of workplace democracy part comes in, right? What's the, you know, in an ongoing way, not just in the question of an NLRB election, but once a union is certified, then the workforce elects a bargaining committee from amongst their co-workers. Those that bargaining committee surveys and membership to see what's important. Those surveys are then, you know, set up to form a bargaining strategy in addition to contracts dealt with and back to membership programs. So I say that all to say that share this with you, to say that, you know, collective bargaining is a democratic process, right? That has, you know, checks and balances, and it's about sort of, you know, equalizing the power relationship between employers and workers, right? And in the end, you know, what that can mean, that basically a relatively simple, not all that complicated process. But there are a huge thing to stick in terms of, you know, for our society as a whole, about whether or not, you know, how many workers get to do that, and how many workers don't get to do that. So, you know, one little other chart that I want to pass around, and this relates union density with both the middle class share of income and the wealth of the top 1% of the economy. This would be better if it were in color, so I apologize for that. But the basic, you may have seen similar things like this before, but the basic gist is, as union density goes, the percentage of workers who get bargaining rights goes down, the number of that's very much appreciated. Oh, yes. You said no, that's good. Thanks. And one doctor does the wrong thing. As union density goes down, the, you know, the corresponding share of income inequality, you know, for the people at the very top of the society goes down. Right? So, you know, what, you know, how as a more society did has a ton to do, you know, with what, you know, these union density numbers. So, you know, that's our charge here at Federation. We feel very serious, you know, we take this very, very, very seriously, that we feel like the question of what kind of society we have, you know, whether we're going to be a society that has relatively shared prosperity and holds open the possibility for social mobility and to widely share the resources that the economy produces, really has a ton to do with the work, with the organizing work that we do. So in order to, you know, so where do we go from here? How do we rebuild? It's every period of growth within the labor movement has had some corresponding change in the form of how workers organize unions. So if we go back to, you know, the first kinds of unions, you know, in the middle part of the 1800s, they were workmen's benevolent associations, people just sort of share resources to figure out, you know, one of the first things they dealt with was what happens when you die, and the pace is very good. right? And there's organizations that have formed with workers to help do that along industry lines. That, you know, there's a lot more, there's a lot more you can do when workers get together. And the night, you know, in the 1870s, the Knights of Labor arise, there's a bit of growth that collapses. In the, you know, the ALCA unions, you know, almost, you know, around the turn of the century, organizing workers along lines of individual trades. They grow up, but they don't continue to grow as the industrial economy changes in the 30s. The CIO unions figure out, well, we don't worry about individual trades, we're going to go across industrial lines. And boom, we see another period of growth in union membership. Same thing happens in the 50s and 60s, when the public part of our economy has grown, and more unions are figuring out how to organize and get rights extended to public sector workers. So again, in the 50s and 60s, there's a big growth of unions in terms of, you know, public sector employees, state employees, teachers, you know, all those things. And we haven't had a period of dramatic growth, you know, since then, right? And so part of our strategy is figuring that if we're going to grow, it's going to be in part based on new forms of organization. And if you look at the rise of what's happened at the worker centers over the last, you know, 10 to 15 years, there's, you know, no doubt this is, we're seeing sort of the first stage of new forms of organization coming into being. But so new forms of organization is part of our strategy. It's also Working America. We talked about that some other times. It's the Palmer story, which is basically the community affiliate of ALCIO. The other piece of the puzzle that we have to get figured out is the question of global capital, right? There's, you know, I lived in Michigan for the last 6 years. You don't need to look very far to realize that capital will move where it wants to move. And we've had a 50-year policy trend across the world to make sure that can happen. And in places like Michigan, it has been on the losing end of that struggle for a while, for not every sector, but in lots of sectors for a while. Well, if the labor is not responding in a corresponding way, not taking, you know, organizing workers across international lines more seriously, you know, we're kind of all kidding ourselves that we're going to change anything in the world. So one of the things that we're doing more of is we're doing more global campaigns. And so that means, you know, getting together workers who work for the same corporations across different countries. So right now we have a big campaign going at T-Mobile. The telecom wireless. T-Mobile is owned by Deutsche Telekom, the German telecom company. They're highly organized there, not, you know, virtually unorganized here in the United States. But they don't just operate here in the United States, they operate in Mexico and South America, in South Africa, in Eastern Europe. And there are some parts of the world that are organized, some parts that are not. So we're doing more and more to bring people not just from the sort of home country and the countries that are operating in a bilateral way, but really to have some multilateral strategies, multilateral coordination between workers and their unions in multiple countries, so that it's not just, you know, a two-way operation between public, you know, companies organized in its home country and not people. And then, you know, the third part of what we do is, you know, realize that part of what we're doing is, you know, retooling and, you know, training. So in the organizing department, we also run a thing called the Organizing Institute, which, you know, trains organizers. We run a program called Union Summer, where college students mostly come and spend a summer interning with either the Federation or one of those unions. And then we run also programs and training for training union researchers. People do the strategic work to figure out, you know, where does T-Mobile want to expand, and, you know, what are the ways that we can use our influence to get their attention. So those are some of the things that we do, you know, just to sort of outline kind of where we're at and what's at stake. I think I'll stop there and leave time for questions and discussion.
So fantastic. We're going until 2:25, just as we do a time check, it's 2:03 right now. We're happy to answer any questions you may have about labor movement, organizing new communities, community groups, and the Young Worker Program. Yes?
Go ahead there.
Sure.
We've had you go up first, everyone, so far. Let's keep it consistent.
Christian, you mentioned earlier that you were going against, I'm not sure if the mobile phone
T-Mobile.
It's owned by...
It's owned by Deutsche Telekom, but they're...
Deutsche Telekom.
Yeah, Deutsche Telekom, yeah.
Verizon's owned by Vodafone.
Right.
So I was thinking, or my question is, how do you, if you needed to go to arbitration, or if you needed to, any sort of legislation or like a sort of court, if you need to go to a court if it's international, who do you go to?
Yeah, so there are different, individual countries generally don't, the laws of any individual one country are usually what's pertinent in a labor issue. You know, every individual country has a process like that, one that I outlined in terms of how workers are organized. That said, there are some, and those vary dramatically, right? There are some countries that have pretty great labor laws that equalize the power between workers and corporations fairly well. There are some countries that have better ones. You know, there are other, avenues to go to, so that are more limited in terms of what impact they have, that sort of cross borders. So, for example, there is, I think in just about every country that T-Mobile's active in, they are effectively assigned onto the International Labor Organization. And the ILO is the branch of the United Nations that works with workers' rights. And there are certain standards that work in the countries that agree to be part of the UN and signatories to the ILO conventions, have agreed to as minimum standards that they'll abide by. But ILO complaints don't really have much teeth. So I was involved in an ILO complaint against the government for not actually enforcing the laws in its own place. I was involved in an ILO complaint where the Bush administration, the National Labor Relations Board, took away like foreign rights from teaching assistants and research assistants in private universities. And we filed an ILO complaint against that. We won the ILO complaint. It was good, maybe a day's worth of press. So that's about it. There are more teeth in some of the other international bodies. So for instance, OECD is the Organization for Economic Development and Cooperation in Europe. And OECD, it was developed in the post-war period, has certain standards for how companies have to behave. And there are some, that actually has a bit more juice because there are some aspects of OECD that have money. So especially the European pension funds like to say, we want companies that we invest in to comply with OECD principles. So you can file, let's say, for example, people work to try to organize in the United States and a company fires. We can actually file an OECD complaint over things like that. And then there can be repercussions in terms of, actually have a bit more teeth in terms of OECD complaints than there can be under U.S. labor law. Even. So there are a number of international conventions that unions and workers use to deal with multinationals, but there's nothing fantastic. There's certainly no sort of one.
Thank you. Well, as we discussed earlier, we've seen like the systematic impact of unionization and working rights throughout the United States and other countries. And I wonder what you are doing to address those problems and educate people on the health impacts. Because I know in Michigan, it's probably kind of like there are many union members who spoke to the survey in the writings area.
Right. Yeah, so there's a lot going on. It's sort of too good a question to answer, and there's a whole political department here that does a lot more of that direct electoral work than we do in the organizing department. But I think the biggest issue, first and foremost,
so the question is, what are we doing to educate people on the ground on it? So the AFL-CIO has a state structure, so there's state federations and central labor councils, and those organizations and the affiliated unions that are part of those work to advocate and push policy or lobby are laws that affect working people in the states, as well, I think you see Wisconsin is a great example of coming together and talking about what's going on, as well as Ohio, where we have a so there's a lot of work that's being done. It's done at the grassroots local level, so we started to invest much more into our own infrastructure. Within several targeted states, we have full-time staff doing rapid response, media, communications work, as well as community outreach. So, like I said before, what we build, we usually build for elections. We had a tendency to tear down after elections. What President Trump does believe is what we build for elections are key, and what that infrastructure is going to be able to do is consistent advocacy and grassroots lobbying on issues that affect people in these states. So that when it comes to health care, minimum wage, anti-union legislation, any other things that fall within our purview, we're going to have the staff and the resources to engage across the labor spectrum on the work that we're doing and participate in advocacy and sharing it's relatively, I don't know what's new for us, but I don't think anybody here can have some. Probably can't be more insight on that, but our job is to be an advocate nonstop for work for people who don't have the privilege of having any integrated.
Yeah, I also ask that a key to that too is also educating our membership and linking different issues together so that they don't see just necessarily right to work legislation as being the only issue that affects their lives as working people, right? So in my previous position here, as an immigration educator, I actually went around to different states and did trainings and workshops with union members on the ground, educating them about our immigration policy and what an immigration system that works for workers might actually look like. And an important piece of that is really linking the struggle, between immigration and right to work legislation. So for instance, in Arizona and states around the South, there's been a rising tide of anti-immigrant laws like SB 1070. And so it's been an important piece to link how those sorts of legislations are also closely tied to right to work legislation, which is also closely tied to voter suppression. And it's no surprise that the same folks behind one of those bills are also behind many others. And there's very key, well-funded, well-strategized, intentional organizations funding all of those pieces. And it definitely takes an entire educational mobilization effort to make that aware and apparent to people. And there's been progress made, even in progress, more than we've done.
And in the practical terms of that education work, there's the workshop piece that the folks who come to the meetings and the sort of leadership group, but on a day-to-day basis, there's also just a ton of, shoe leather, one-on-one organizing in the workplace, work in the phone banks, all the trying to kind of methods,
So, would you attribute this consistent decline in the union membership rate since 1967 to natural philosophy changes technologically, or would you consider it something more political, like a full attack on the union membership and workers' rights side of our union?
Sure. I think there's a little bit of both, right? There's some amount of movement to the right, and I also would say those aren't necessarily opposed to each other. A woman who was on an organizing committee at Columbia University, or I think this was there, this was about 2 years ago or so, called The Invisible Hand. Her name is Kim Phillips Fine. It's a book about the rise of sort of right-wing free market ideology from the 40s through the 70s. It basically sort of, this didn't come from nowhere, that, the Trump office we're living with was a concerted effort to fight back against unions, to build credibility for the idea that free market laissez-faire capitalism was the, scientific law of how economies work. That's what the right legislature believed when it was built, but But that was a concerted effort. It was really, really well detailed and gave those signs. But I think that the declining in density in the United States is a product of it. Number one, the economy has changed pretty dramatically, right? And has changed in parts of, in areas where there was high levels of median density. So, Michigan is a fantastic example of this, right? You need a lot fewer people to run an auto factory today than you did 20 years ago. That's one piece of the puzzle. We look at productivity gains in areas of the economy that are high level of density and stuff, right? So a lot fewer people are employed in, large sectors that have high, very, very high levels of median density. There's also been a move to the south, to areas where there's, especially in the manufacturing part of the economy, to areas where there's less, fewer units, and so the climate organizing is a little bit tougher. And there's been a big move offshore too, right? To just move production out of the United States entirely, right? So that, so there's changes in the economy. But then, that's not to say that there haven't been changes in Western European economies, right? German economy has changed a ton, but median density has been relatively steady in Germany if you sort of compare the US and Germany. So what's the difference? Another key piece of the difference between the United States and Western Europe, for example, to answer this question of why is the density down so much, it's also that the road to organizing to individual workplace representation is so hard in the United States. It's really pretty dramatic. I mean, in most organizing campaigns, employers threaten to shut the place down. There's a whole literature that we'd be happy to share, perhaps you're already aware of, that about the kinds of legal and illegal things that employers do in the context of when workers try to organize. And the debt is absolutely stacked against workers. So the polling data, and there's data, polling data on sort of if you workers want unions, when you ask people in the survey, it's like, hey, if there was a, if you got a union in your job, would you want that? It's like something, the number has gone up and down a little bit over the last 10 years or so, the questions are being asked, but it's run between about 63% and 58%. So there's a dramatic, unbelievable wide difference between when you ask people, hey, if you could be in the union, would you want to? The majority of people say yes to that. You compare that to, overall union density in the economy being about 12%, and private sector being down to 7%. That's the crux of the organizing problem.
That polling data is also reflective of young people, but it's not at 53% to 60%, it's around 40%. And if you think about it, that's pretty high considering that we don't educate people, especially young people, about the union or labor movement. So if we were to do, we haven't done anything on it, and so still 4 out of 10 people said that they had opportunity to join the union. You can get that information from a report that came out called the State of America by Young Invincibles and Females.
I'm really going to have to cut this off. I really hate to do that, but
we have a stamp that's coming, unfortunately.
I don't see the cats coming.
Well, yeah. You don't think we can all fit in one, like one of those hilarious old comic cartoons?
Yeah.
But we want to thank you very, very much.